agaíú na tá fádarrámh chuig an chlár staire, an nachtáachchaint le lí a ghir óachrán ar an IRB. An histípógam tú naidirchaide I speaking with William J. Maguire, President of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and we're going to discuss the history of the organisation from its development in America and to the leading place it has had in Irish history up to the formation of the revolution really in 1916 at the rebellion.
Thank you, Seamus, and good evening, and good evening to your listeners.
Very good. Bill, you might tell us, we'll say, about the beginnings, you know, the beginnings are both in Ireland and in America.
That's true. It's the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the Fenian Brotherhood, they're the same organisation, but one was founded for America and the other for here. And they wanted to get sovereignty is the important point with the Irish Republican Brotherhood. The sovereignty, the people are sovereign. That's what it's all about, and they have a sovereign right to education, home, hospital care, own their land. The land of Ireland belongs to the citizens of Ireland, and to them alone. And then you come up to 1916. My granduncle had a great, in 1914, he and Sam Maguire, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, were looking for...
Take it easy small bit now, we'll say from the beginning, it's very important because it's the famine Irish we're talking about that they recruited amongst, wasn't it?
That's exactly
it, talking about sovereignty. Those people knew that they were after being shafted in their
own
country.
They were, of course. And I think it's important that we say, it's coming up to St. Patrick's weekend, and the important point, we celebrate St. Patrick as the national saint, which is correct. But what most people don't understand is that the Irish Republican Brotherhood were founded on St. Patrick's Day in 1858 at 16 Lumber Street in Dublin. And you know, the tricolour flag that flew over the GPO, the sovereign seals and harps, the shamrock in Eastern.
Everything really came out of that, Billy.
Everything came out of that. They were the ones who succeeded in having a sovereign.
We say in America there was a huge Irish population in the 1860s, and you had the Civil War period.
That's exactly it. And James K. Maguire, he was chairman of Friends of Irish Freedom in America, and he collected the money, for the Irish Republican Brother and the Fenian Brotherhood.
Okay.
And that money was collected for to set up universities, industries like the ESB and Sugar Company and all those companies.
Development of the country.
Yeah. And universities and. We've said before on your program that University of Limerick was founded by the Irish Republican Brotherhood as a technological university to teach people how to govern the state.
Well, I think the Irish always had a very great importance in education.
Education is everything, Seamus, for them, and especially when you see, but those industries that they set up around the University of Limerick, very important, and it was a technological university. You know, when you talk about computers, you're talking about 1950. And you're talking about that with computers and that today, how far ahead they were of their time and that university that, you can educate yourself now. Young people are educating themselves through computers. And that all came out of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. And that's what's so important about that.
All right, Billy. And you have an important work with you here, The King, the Kaiser and Irish Freedom by Kevin J. Maguire.
Well, he was chairman of Friends of Irish Freedom. He's one of our family as well in America. And he was the one who collected the money. And he was a great politician. Woodrow Wilson was afraid of his life of him, the support he had in America.
All right, huge Irish population, of course.
Huge, and he had the support of all those people, and they all contributed. The unfortunate thing about the whole, all that money that was collected, the Irish Republican Brothers didn't get not one dollar.
I know.
They didn't get a gun or a bullet for the War of Independence.
Because it went on for generations, Billy, didn't it? It has really, the collecting
well,
the money.
Well, that money, I should always ask Fianna Fáil, where did you get the money to found Fianna Fáil, De Valera should say.
I know.
And where did they get the money to buy the Irish Press? That's where they got it. And where did Cumann na Gael get the money to set up Fine Gael? Right. That's where they got it.
Well, the Irish diaspora, I suppose, and their contributions to the fight at home was always very important. But here, this is an important work, Billy, and I think I'll quote a small bit from
it. Yes, I think it's important that you know, on the founding of the...
That's right, and we'll say this is prior to 1916 also, to give you the continuity of history. And this chapter is called The Uprising of 1865. And 1865, of course, was the Fenian, the effort that the Fenian revolt, and it says the Ulster revolutionary movement of 1865, known as the Fenian movement, failed sadly. Yet history records that the uprising led to the birth of the Home Rule Party, the defeat of the landlords in their long political control of Ireland, and the scaring of England into granting some local reforms. The records of history would be searched in vain to prove where England ever made any concessions to Ireland, except through fear of revolution, or because the Irish held the balance of power in the House of Commons. The Fenian movement was organised in New York, and America furnished the supplies. It was a purely revolutionary society directed at the British government of Ireland. The foremost leaders were James Stephens, Charles J. Kickham, John O'Leary, Thomas Clark Coluby. All but O'Leary were Protestants. It is a curious fact in the history of Ireland that a majority of her foremost rebels have been Protestants, as well as being poets and writers. The leaders of the Fenians in New York were John O'Mahony, Michael Doheny, and Colonel Michael Cochran of the famous Fighting 69th Regiment of New York. They had the support of three New York newspapers. In April 1865, the Civil War in the United States was closed by the surrender of the South at Appomattox, and the Irish regiments enrolled in the Fenian organisation by the thousands. Large sums of money were secured for arming of the Fenian Brotherhood in Ireland. The British government struck quickly before the guns from America could be delivered. The leaders were arrested and charged with treason. Stevens effected a prison conspiracy and escaped. Luby, O'Leary and Kickham were sent to prison for 20 years at hard labour. Others were sent to prison for life. Many were flogged on the backs with whips steeped in vinegar. The uprising in seven counties were put down. An interesting enough account, Bill, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I like James because he's very down to earth, and he's very accurate, and he knows what he's talking about. You know,
right. He was at the centre of things, sure, wasn't he?
Of course, he's the very centre of thing. And
right, and I always liked the invasion of Canada, Billy. They always threatened Canada. You know, they did it in 1848 as well. Because I suppose Britain was probably vulnerable there. It was such a huge country.
That's it. Well, I always think of Canada and Australia, you know, the crown of England, and it's all crown land. But it's not the crown that is the sovereign, it is the harp. And I think that should come out today, you know. They claim, you know, that this... But when the crown is not in residence, it is the Union Jack that flies. But when the crown is in residence, it is the harp. And the harp is the covenant between God and man with all the information and knowledge for his planet Earth and our civilization. And our sovereign seed with 12 strings, it is the psaltery. The Book of Psalms is the psaltery.
It was taken first day by the Henry VIII, Billy, wasn't it?
Yes.
A long time
ago.
And
that's what they based their empire on. But that empire is not correct, because that sort of sovereignty that they talk about, our sovereignty comes from the 1916 proclamation and the 32 county election of 1918. And the sovereign constitution, and that's very important. And the people became sovereign on the 21st of January 1919 under that 32 county election of 1918 from Vaughan's Hotel, and we bought Vaughan's Hotel in 1917 on behalf of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Oglin Aherne and Cumann Amon, and all those organisations were all part of that, and that was the headquarters, and they were the ones who achieved our sovereign government. Dáil Éireann is our sovereign government, and when you refer to Dáil Éireann, you're referring to the 32 counties of Ireland and all our territory.
All right.
And when you refer to the Dáil, the Royal Dáil and Senate, that was imposed in 1922 as a British apartheid system for the 26 and 6 counties of Ireland as an Orange Free State and a provisional government. That's all you have today. And I criticise those because they're claiming in the European Union now, where we should not be in the European Union.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back, Billy. We'll say to the development of the organisation in America in the 19th century, following the Civil War and the invasion of Canada, they had an involvement with the dynamiting war in the 1870s, hadn't they?
That's very much. They were indeed, and
that was bombing in Britain.
That is, and I said about my granduncle Tom, And in 1914, they were looking for volunteers. The Circle and the Cell, it was known as, to collect the intelligence on the Crown Forces. And he volunteered with Sam Maguire. And Sam got himself into, who was a Church of Ireland, he was a Protestant, and from Cork, he got himself into the post office in Britain.
All right. And he rose quickly there, Billy, didn't he?
He did, and he got to the right position where all the documents coming from all over the war and the empire were coming through his desk. So he had all the intelligence. And those brotherhoods in Egypt and in India, they were all very helpful to us. And Tom, he joined up and he got into the regiment in Calcutta. Now, Tom was a very clever man, and all his life since he was a child, you know, he took on that role of military. He knew everything about wars and battles and everything else. That's what he did.
Was he the man that went to South Africa, Billy?
He was in South Africa as well. He did and banking, and that was the very important. But he collected all that intelligence in Calcutta in India, and he sent it through Sam Maguire's desk at the, and Sam Maguire picked that up every Saturday. He went to Vaughan's Hotel.
He came to Dublin every weekend, Billy.
Every Saturday he came to Dublin. I think they only worked a half day on a Saturday. And he got on the boat, the train and the boat. And to Vaughan's Hotel with all that intelligence for the War of Independence. All those battles, Kilmichael and all those, they were all, that intelligence was very important. And Sam Maguire's intelligence.
He had seen a position in the intelligence the IRA, Billy, didn't he?
He did.
He was seen at the Collins, wasn't he?
Oh, he was the principal one. Collins wasn't very junior to Sam Maguire. But he went back then, and he was only just a turnaround in Dublin, and he was back, and he had to be back at his desk at 7 o'clock in the morning in London. So he was there on Monday morning.
He got very little thanks for that.
Got none at all on the abuse, and he died of starvation in the end of his life.
Poverty anyway.
And his sister as well, you know.
I know.
And that was the thanks that he got for it anyway, you know. Right. But he was also, he had to be very careful, you see, because eventually in the end, the British, of course, he was caught with the intelligence at the very end of the whole situation.
Was he caught, yeah.
And my granduncle was as well. He was poisoned over all that, and so was his wife in 1930. He died. My granduncle died in 1925. He's buried in Limerick.
All right.
But he got all that intelligence. He was a brilliant man for that, and had the experience. They didn't have any military experience.
All right.
And of course, Tom was the great expert on guerrilla warfare, and that's what they did, especially in South Africa.
I mentioned the dynamiting war, Billy. We'll say Tom Clark was one of the men that they sent from America to England. And he was caught on a trumped up charge, but they put him away, I think, for 15 years, isn't it? But when he came out, he rejuvenated the IRB.
That's exactly it. Now, I would have known, you know, in Limerick being the same for, you know, the Dailies and the Claremidge Daily and all those people.
Limerick is very central, really, Billy, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely. People don't understand that, you know. And, I mean, the Dailies, they had their bakery there opposite the Franciscans. Ours was only around the corner of Arthur's Quay. And all our families, I mean, I knew all those. I knew Tom Clark's, his son, very well. He used to come and have Christmas dinner with us. And he had another brother as well who worked most of his time in England. I mean, I knew all those, Madge Daly and, Kathleen Clark and all those people.
Okay.
They were all in Willowbank, and they were all coming and going. Right. Because the Supreme Council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, my father moved it to Willowbank, and that would be around 1940.
But getting back to, we'll say, 1916, Billy, and development towards revolution, when the Great War started in August 1914, 3rd of August, I think, the IRB leadership met more or less immediately and decided that there would be a rebellion in Ireland before the war was over.
That's correct. That's what they did.
And they worked towards that then.
They worked towards that, and that's how they did.
Right.
Now, there was a lot of people saying in 1916 that they weren't ready and all this, and it might have happened. It was a faction of them went off. But the point is, if they didn't do it, it might never have happened.
Yeah, more than likely would not.
And with the, with the Ord and the sinking of the Ord and all the arms and everything else.
Right.
But they continued on, and then on the...
Most remarkably, Billy, is that they were never broken. They were never injured by British.
And a very important point to make is that the tricolour flag that flew over the GPO in 1916.
All right.
That was never captured. And Dermot Lynch, and in fact, I put one in your bag there, and we might read that as well before the programme finishes. Dermot Lynch, he took down, I knew Dermot Lynch. You see, I knew all these people coming to Willowbank.
All right.
And Dermot Lynch, he took down that the tricolour flag. The British never captured it. They captured the Irish Republican Greed flag.
They did. Irish Republic was written on it.
On it. And that's what they captured, but they never captured the tricolour flag, and we still hold that today. And that tricolour flag for John Francis Marr in, what, 1848, you're right, James.
That's right.
And I'm not good at dates, but you know, but it was ratified, which people must understand that on the 20th, they went to the, you know, the sovereign constitution.
All right,
which
you're up now at the first rebellion.
I am.
We might just stick with the rebellion because it's very important.
Well, I think it's important to say about Lombard Street, and that was...
All right.
That's where it was founded.
Okay. And there's a plaque up there, Billy, isn't
there?
There's
a plaque and there's a sovereign seal up there.
Okay.
And we go there, as you know, Seamus, and we commemorate there as well. We start in the Mansion House on the 21st of January.
All right. And, of course, and tell us the significance of the 21st of January, Billy.
It's our Independence Day.
Okay.
And that's when Dáil Éireann, when you speak of Dáil Éireann, you understand you're talking about the 32 counties of Éire.
That's right. That's sure. It means the Assembly
that's
of Ireland,
what it means.
Billy.
And it's the sovereign government of Dáil Éireann. And if you read the proclamation and you read the sovereign constitution, that's where it was ratified under the 32 county election of 1918 from Vaughan Sertel.
Right, by a large
that's
majority.
Why we, yes. And that's why we, that's what we base it on.
All right.
And the six counties of Ireland, they're part of United Ireland.
It was part of the British imposition, I suppose, 1626.
You know, this thing of, in 1922, King George V, he imposed that British apartheid system for the 26 and six counties of Ireland.
Right, and he took the sovereignty on himself, Billy, from the people.
He took the sovereign for himself. And, of course, we only have a provisional government. It's there in Sarstat Éire, if anyone wants to read it. But the important point of that is, that's what General de Gaulle was still on about, that how can a provisional government sit at the table in the European Union?
Right.
You can't do it.
Well, we go back, back again to the rebellion, Billy, and they're defeated. Right, after 6 days, although you have the page of the Irish Weekly Times, you know, and it says that was the most dreadful day in the history of Dublin. The first time in 700 years that they had been denied that the English or the British or Anglo Normans, whatever you want to call them at whatever stage, were denied the use of the capital of Ireland.
Yeah, well, you see, you know what happened, James, after all that went on. But they were great people. And the Irish Volunteers, 8 strings IV on their buttons. They carried sovereignty. And you read the proclamation and it's all about sovereignty.
Yes, it's very important. All right, we'll take a short break then.
All right.
On the history programme tonight, I'm speaking with William J. Maguire of Lee House in Kappa, and Billy is president of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which was a very, I suppose, the most important organisation in modern Irish history. And it basically came out of what was allowed to happen between 1845 and 49 or 52, I suppose, when the poor were starved in a land of plenty. And the Irish that went to America, they never... forgave the English and those who cooperated with them in their terrible suffering, because the food was being moved out of Ireland while they were being starved, and it went on year after year after year, so that the American attitude towards British rule in Ireland is much harder than it is for the Irish at home. And there were hundreds of thousands of Irishmen in America at that time, and they formed an important element within the armed forces of both the North and South during the Civil War, and they were good soldiers. They got great respect for the Irish through their bravery in the field of battle. And after the Civil War is over, they organised a rebellion for Ireland, but as usual it was riddled with spies and informers. But they invaded Canada and they defeated the British in Canada, but they were undermined again there by the Masonic people really within the America and in Canada and in Britain. But in the 1870s, they're behind the dynamiting war, which, you know, really frightened the British. The newspapers of the 1860s and 70s are afraid of these Fenians because they bombed the House of Parliament and they burned the underground. And But the Warlow people were given very harsh sentences in bad conditions in British jails. And one of those at the time was Thomas Clark, Thomas J. Clark, who would be a senior man in 1916 in the proclamation. He was given the honour of being the first to sign the proclamation. So with the outbreak of war in Europe, you know that the Irish always held that England's difficulty was Ireland's opportunity, Irish nationalists anyway. And they decided that there would be a rebellion in Ireland before the war was over. And when they went out on rebellion, and the best authorities say that they mounted 1,600. Liam Lynch, who was a part of it and who was a senior IRB man and who has left very important writings, and he tells all that story. You have something on Liam Lynch, Billy?
Dermot Lynch is a very important man because he's the only one, he's the definitive work on 1916.
He was there, Billy.
He was there. He's the only one that was in the GPO, that survived the GPO.
He was sentenced to death, all right. Was he sentenced, Billy?
He was down the line. Himself and De Valera were the only two because he was an American citizen at that stage. And I knew Dermot Lynch very well because he used to come to Willowbank.
Okay.
And I was at the launch of his book last year down in Cork. We had a great day.
All right.
For Simon Covey, it actually launched. He was from Manon Bridge, is where he was.
All right.
But it's very important, and I'm reading from his book that was launched last year, and it is Dermot Lynch, a Forgotten Irish Patriot. Okay. Now, as I said, he's the definitive work.
She was a local school teacher that wrote about him, Billy, wasn't it?
Yes.
McCutcheon, whatever her name
was. Yeah, yeah.
Goff.
And but what's important about Dermot is he survived all that, and he was with America and Ireland. He was between the two, so he was very much in it. He knew what was going on. So in 1917, and that's when we bought Vaughan's Hotel after 1916, because they didn't, all they had in Vaughan's Hotel up to then, 1916, they had a room from Mrs. Vaughan, and they used to rent that. But in 1917, we put our hand in our pocket and we bought it for the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Oglin Éireann and Cumann na Mban and all those organisations came out of there in the Fenian.
And you had the publishing of An Táaghlach, Billy.
The Táaghlach, that was very important from there. And
huge numbers of people being distributed every week.
Oh, yeah, and it was
80,000 or something.
Yes, and that was very important to keep them. That was the only way they had in those days. But that was in 1917 when we, the reorganisation of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. In 1917, that a divergence of opinion as to the strategy became apparent between De Valera and the revitalised Irish IRB. Eamon De Valera was a reluctant secret society member, and he distanced himself from his former comrades in the IRB, arguing that the organisation was no longer needed in the campaign for national independence. In contrast, Lynch was adamant, as was Michael Collins, that the IRB campaign had to continue and that it was only through IRB methods that independence would be achieved. Now, I can tell you that De Valera was 100% for the IRB up to 1916. And everything had to be IRB, IRB. The minute he was taken in Britain, and he was brainwashed there by the British, and he came back and he was totally against the IRB. And you even hear people saying he was never a member of the IRB. He was a member of the IRB.
Okay.
And you can understand that he was, and on this is written in 1917, McGuire was purchased once there on behalf of the IRB and as their GHQ. It became known that De Valera was illegitimate and could not hold the sovereignty and was colluding with the British government. This is 1917.
Yeah.
And I think that is.
Yeah, but Lynch writes that.
Yeah, and that's what he, you know, and you know, that's important to bring in these people. How is it the stepping stones that we were talking about in 1922, 92 years on? and we still only have stepping stones going round in the circle. Where is Dáil Éireann, and where's our sovereign government?
Aye.
You know, we're going to get thrown out of Europe.
Yeah.
And I saw recently on the Enda Kenny, he signed the sovereign seal without error. For Croatia's accession to the EU treaty. That's treason to do that. He has no right. He's only a provisional Taoiseach, and that's what he is. Right. And they should come clean, and they should stop all this lies and deception. And that's what General de Gaulle was on about. Only a sovereign government has the right to sit at the table in Europe. And we have a sovereign government, and they're not allowed.
I mean, the split in the Civil War, how did that affect the IRB?
It's very badly. Sure, a lot of them went.
And Collins was a senior officer.
Collins had stepped down, as had De Valera stepped down from the sovereign government of Dáil Éireann. And this is what most people go, you have two governments. You have the sovereign government and you have the provisional government imposed by King George V.
The settlement, yeah.
Now, people think that Dáil Éireann, sometimes say Dáil Éireann voted. Dáil Éireann never voted for the Anglo-Irish Treaty. It never voted for the EEC accession or the EU accession. It was the Royal Dáil and Senator Ráchtas that was imposed by King George V that voted for his Royal Dáil and Senator Ráchtas.
Because the principal difference, Billy, is that Dáil Éireann represented 32 counties.
Dáil Éireann, I mean,
after that, Leinster House did 26.
That represents
6 more.
And that was imposed. And that's the point of the whole issue. And we should have our sovereign. After 92 years, and they still haven't sorted it out.
Should we come up for the 100th anniversary of 28?
And they're trying to take over. And as you know, Seamus, and we have been airbrushed out of history. And they're trying to pretend that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael founded the state. You hear it every day. The Radio Éireann comes out in the morning and says, the government, we only have a provisional government. And you hear the minister for this, all you have is a provisional minister and a provisional Taoiseach. And it's time that we faced up. We're always going to be, it's all about money and these big corporations. You saw the GAA, which was the backbone of our independence.
All right. Yeah, we should have.
And they changed in 2008. They took the sovereign seal and air off the medal. How dare they? That's an Irish Republican Brotherhood organisation. And thank God we have
they
put it back in.
Stealthily, didn't they?
Oh, they didn't tell anybody of that. And we're being conned. Look at and the state bankrupt. And this is one thing you never hear. Everyone is mentioning, the state. And when the state was founded, no one ever defines the state. The state is the sovereign republic of Éire, Dáil Éireann and the Dáil Éireann courts and the War of Independence. And all those symbols of the state, the tricolour flag, the proclamation, the sovereign constitution, the sovereign seals and the harps, and the Easter Lily and the champ, they were ratified under the 32 county election of 1918 in the cabinet room, and before that in Vaughan's Hotel, and they went to the cabinet room on the 21st of January, and they were ratified by the will of the people, of all the people of Ireland, and all the people of Ireland became sovereign citizens on the 21st of January 1919, and that's why you are the people are sovereign, and they're entitled to the four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. Man's intellect and reason, and his five senses. And then we have.
How would you see things going, Billy?
I'm ashamed to say the people just won't stand up for their sovereignty. You know, they're being treated as absolute dirt by the provisional government. I mean, to betray our people like that, and to keep on getting away with it all the time. I know from and they do come after you, as you know, if you stand up. We saw it this year on the 21st of January, our Independence Day, Seamus, when the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Oisin Quinn, wouldn't allow the Irish Republican Brotherhood to commemorate in the Mansion House. There isn't even a plaque up in the Mansion House to say that this is where the state was founded. There was no other state founded in Éire, only by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and between 1916, 1919, 1921. The Royal Dáil and Senator Ráchtas is not a state. It's a corporation imposed by King George V to make King George V remunerative for King George V. It's all about money and all the assets of the state.
The British influence in the Civil War was huge, Billy, I think.
Look, the War of Independence, we won the War of Independence, but what we didn't win was the Civil War, and that treaty was under the threat of immediate and terrible war, and they imposed that civil war. It was the British, and they're still controlling it today.
Right,
and that's who imposed the Civil War. If they don't recognise our sovereignty and our sovereign government, I mean, who do they think they did treaties with in that, you know?
Right.
That's very important for people to know. And it's very important to know for people that on St. Patrick's Day, one of the reasons why we celebrate St. Patrick's Day is that we're on our national saint, St. Patrick, but the Irish Republican Brotherhood were founded in 1858 down at 16 Lumber Street in Dublin. And if you go down Pier Street, go down by Trinity, go down Pier Street, go under the railway bridge,
okay,
and about the next traffic lights, that's Lombard Street there, and just turn to the left of the track. It's only down there. It isn't down there, 100 yards. And we'll be there after the parade on St. Patrick's Day, we'll read our proclamation. And then we're hoping this year that American journalists and cameras and that, we've asked RTE to come down and to celebrate it. And we'll go to Arbor Hill then, to where our members are buried in 1916.
Okay.
The British policy has always been to execute or get rid of every IRB person because they hold the sovereignty of the state in trust for the citizens. And I said about those, the tricolour and all those, the proclamation, we hold the sovereign government of Dáil Éireann in trust for the sovereign citizens of the 32 counties of Éire.
And it's quite amazing, Billy, we say the stirrings that's in the people 100 years after when it all began.
Yes. Well, we're hoping now that, you know, coming up, if people were only told the truth and given the information.
All right.
And you know, proud. You know, they have their passport.
Okay.
12 strings.
Yeah.
If you didn't have that sovereign seal on your passport, where would you go?
Right.
You know, okay. And it's so important. And we have a wonderful history there about the harps and the shamrocks and the Easter lilies. There's no other country has what we have.
Very good, Billy. I'd like to thank you very much for coming in. And I'm Stuart Smallbone and St. Patrick, Billy, our national saint, is coming right up. And you'll be back again and we'll take up some other topics. And I'm sure you have a busy time coming up over the next couple of years. So I'd like to wish William J. Maguire, President of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, every success in the future. Go to market, Billy.
Thank you, Seamus, and thank you to your listeners.
Very good. So I mentioned St. Patrick, and St. Patrick is our national saint, and he was a very important man because the true faith might have been here, or was here, I suppose, in parts before Patrick came, but he showed us how to read and write, which was a major advance for our people, because even though they had a high standard of education, they didn't have a written alphabet, and it was a major success. We were able to record our proper histories from then on. So I'm going to read a small bit here now from a book called The Saints and Martyrs of Ireland, and it is by Patrick Montague, and an interesting enough little publication now. And I'll start off. So then, the 17th of March, Patrick, the Apostle of Ireland. For having annexed Ireland to the kingdom of God, amid so many sufferings and tribulations, with unrivalled Christian heroism, his people have honoured and blessed him throughout the ages, as has been the case with no other national apostle. Such was the judgment of Dom Louis Gougard, one of the many Benedictine monks who have done so much to establish the prestige of the saints of the Golden Age of Ireland. A modern Irish historian commented whimsically that Patrick had confused his own story for posterity, and that historians have been confusing it ever since. In his little confession and his letter to Caroticus, Patrick has told us a little, but not enough, about his family and place of birth. Still more important, perhaps, is the fact that he has given no clear information about the 20 years or so that elapsed between his escape from captivity in Ireland and his return as apostle. As a result, a great mass of literature has been produced that is full of learned speculation on the facts of his personal history. It is accepted that he was a Celt, but not a Gael. It is also accepted that his name was Sucat, not Patricius, which was the old Roman title of nobility, still bestowed by popes at that time. It is also accepted that he was a captive in Ireland in his boyhood for some 6 years. is it was at the end of this period that the legend of Patrick really began. His escape began with his conviction that voices were calling him to return to his fatherland. His great destiny began then, for at a later date other voices from Ireland compelled him to come back and walk once more among us. Thus arose one of the great traditions of Ireland, the voice of the people. When Pope John Paul II set foot on Irish soil in 1979, almost his first words to the Irish people were that he too, like Patrick, had come to the Irish. He had too had heard the voice of the Irish. So much has been written about Patrick's place in history that details of the universal cult associated with him tend to be forgotten. Yet at the very beginning of his missions, he initiated two traditions centred on symbols which he chose, the shamrock to illustrate the Trinity, and by lighting the fire at Tara, he initiated the tradition that the fire of Christ would never be extinguished in Ireland. The cult of Patrick began in France long before he received the title of Patricius, which was immediately prior to his departure for his mission, and probably in 431. The centre of the cult is a few miles west of Tours on the River Loire, around the town of St. Patrick, which is named after him. The legend is very strong and still persistent in that locality, that Patrick not only spent the years there between his escape and the start of his mission, but that his home was there, the fatherland to which the voices summoned him. It is the people of this area who most firmly believe that it was the nephew of St. Martin of Tours, that he was the nephew of St. Martin of Tours, and that he became a monk in St. Martin's great abbey at Montier. We'll take a short break there now. According to the history program tonight, I've been speaking with Billy Maguire, William J. Maguire, President of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and as I was saying at the introduction, a very important organisation, the most important organisation really that the present state came out of it, and that it had a central role in Irish history, but that role was very much diminished at the time of the Civil War. A lot of things were diminished by the Civil War, and during that Civil War I often mentioned that by June 1923 there were 55,000 men in the Free State Army, and that about half of them had come directly from the British Army, and they came in at officer rank as well. I remember seeing a photograph of some Free State capture of some town or other, but he's a General Murphy and he's out of the British Army he comes. So that hasn't been properly written up, but I suppose if an academic writes the truth in the old Ireland up to now anyway, he'll get it in the neck. But that went well, and we're talking about St. Patrick because St. Patrick's Day is next Monday, and St. Patrick, every Irish man and woman are proud of St. Patrick. So I'll continue reading this, and it says, the level to which the Irish have raised the sanctity of Patrick can be judged by the fact that his name occurs in the most usual form of salutation in the Gaelic language of Ireland, and in the English translation most commonly used. The standard expression is, may God, Mary and Patrick bless you. His name occurs widely in prayers and blessings throughout Ireland. Among the oldest devotions of Ireland is the prayer used by travellers invoking the protection of St. Patrick and the elegy of Patrick. Another tradition that it has the date of his feast, the 17th of March, in the winter. He is alleged to have promised prosperity to those who seek his intercession on that day. And particularly attractive and persistent legend is that the peace of Christ will reign over all Ireland when the Palm and the Shamrock meet, which means that St. Patrick's Day falls on Palm Sunday. The continuity of devotion to Patrick is assured by the continued tradition of pilgrimages to Croagh Patrick and Lough Derg. There are very few people in Ireland who have never been to one or other of these during their lifetime. The fame of Lough Derg has been firmly established outside Ireland by a number of foreign writers. The most notable example is Il Purgatorio de San Patricio, a play written by the famous Spanish dramatist Calderon. There is no national saint so closely associated with the people as St. Patrick is with the Irish. He's the communist. His is the communist name given to their churches throughout the world. That is, in fact, a St. Patrick's Church in Rome. The annual procession of St. Patrick's Day in America was the greatest, had the greatest demonstrations of their kind in the world. On that day in 1932, the 15th centenary of his arrival in Ireland as apostle, the Mass of the Eucharistic Congress assembled the largest gathering of Irish people possibly in the history of Ireland up to that time. More recently, in 1979, this was surpassed by Pope John Paul II, following, as he said, in the steps of St. Patrick, celebrated Mass in Dublin before what may have been the largest congregation in the history of the Catholic Church. The guidebooks of Italy are referred to an unusual dedication to him there. It is called The Well of St. Patrick at Orvieto. It is exceptionally deep, with 248 steps from the surface to the well. It was built at the orders of Pope Clement II to provide water for the city during its periodic sieges, and was completed in 1537. The connection with Patrick arises because the project was carried out by a member of the San Gallo family, which derives its name from the Irish Saint Gall. As a result, the completed project was dedicated to the Irish apostle by the builder, San Gallo. A very common proverb in Italian now perpetuates the tradition. According to this, big spenders are said to have pockets as deep as the well of St. Patrick. Finally, the Lorica, or breastplate of St. Patrick, is the literary treasure of Ireland. It is alleged to be the invocation which led him and his party safely to the confrontation with the High King and the Druids at Tara at the beginning of his mission. In Irish, the breastplate is known as the Fla Fia, the Deic's Cry. This name is based on the legend that St. Patrick and his eight companions, on their way to confront the Ardrí or High King at Tara, were miraculously changed into deer, so avoiding the attention of the king's guards, sent to intercept them and prevent their arrival at Tara. Christ be with me, Christ be before me, Christ be behind me, Christ be with me. Christ be beneath me, Christ be above me. Christ be at my right, Christ be at my left. Christ be in the fort, Christ be in the chariot, Christ be in the ship. Christ be in the heart of everyone who thinks of me. Christ be in the mouth of everyone who speaks to me. Christ in every eye that sees me. Christ in every ear that hears me. And that's what it says now about St. Patrick. Very good. So I have another small bit here. The small one now. This is Liam de Pair's work, St. Patrick's World. And Liam de Pair was a very important scholar. And I think this was considered a kind of synopsis of his learning. And I'm going to read a small bit about Ireland in the 5th century. That's an awful long time ago, you know, that we became Christian very early, and we had, written vernacular very early. And this is Ireland in the 5th century. We have no precise or detailed information about the Ireland to which Palladius and Patrick, Auxilius and Secundinus came. Most of what we can read about this country as it then was comes from writings of later centuries, and these are unreliable in various ways. The writers themselves in the 7th century and later lacked adequate records and tended to project circumstances of their own day into the past. They did this either because they were unaware of the changes that had taken place in the interval, or because they were partisan and had an interest in maintaining fictions about the origins of dynasties, churches, or property-related relations they served. However, by putting together these accounts, treated with due caution, along with evidence of other kinds, for example, from archaeology, we may venture a tentative reconstruction. It should begin with the basic fact of physical geography, since the island was in the same location then as now, was of more or less the same extent, give or take a little tideland here and there, and had a climate which was different, but not very much different. However, if superficial aspects was not at all the same as today, there were no towns or cities as in the present day, and even in the medieval sense. Forests and bogs were extremely extensive, and the numerous undrained lakes and river valleys and lowlands created many watery wildernesses in which the travelling stranger would be almost literally at sea. Settlement, accordingly, was discontinuous, and most inhabited tracts of land would have had something of the character of clearings in a land where nature was, and no doubt, red in tooth and claw, but overwhelmingly green. Yet the country had long been inhabited, and for the best part of 3,000 years had been grazed and cultivated. It is possible to make a reasonable guess at the order of magnitude of the population, probably between a fifth of a million and half a million. The people were descended from immigrants who had arrived over many centuries from different parts of southern, western and northern Europe. I no doubt had had remote ancestors in North Africa too. There may well have been a number of different vernaculars spoken by small communities here and there in isolated lands, but we can be certain that by the 5th century, one language was dominant throughout the island, Irish, a language of the Celtic group. This had by then virtually displaced all other tongues that were spoken in ancient times. The unity of speech was reflected in a unity of culture throughout the country. It was a wholly rural society, and then as now, cattle were of the highest importance in the economy and in the estimation of the countryside. They were a primary measure of exchange value and of a man's or of a woman's social worth. Sheep too were important, and people of the time also hunted and trapped deer and other game. They planted wheat, oats, barley and flax, and to some extent they managed the bounty of the forest and grazed pigs in the woodlands to provide their most favoured meat. They used handmills to grind their grain, from which they made beer and porridge. This was heavy labour, the lot of slave women. Whether they had bread at this date is less certain. They consumed a variety of dairy foods, including milk, butter, cheese and curds. All this can be inferred from the attested customs of later centuries, together with such scanty archaeological evidence as there is. But even that simple economy was undergoing rapid and significant change in the 5th century. For example, a primitive type of plough was to be replaced at about this time by the coulter plough, which allowed heavier and more fertile soils to be cultivated. A new type of handmill came into use, and water mills were soon to appear. It is also probably the time when beekeeping was introduced to Ireland. Most of these changes are due to the influence of the Roman Empire. Roman influence, too, was to be the principal agent of change in the transformation of society. Northern Ireland, nor any part of it, was wholly self. Neither Ireland nor any part of it was wholly self-sufficient, and from distant prehistoric times, there has been some external as well as internal trade, as well as other forms of intercourse with the outside world. The imports from the Roman Empire had included wine, for which some at least of the tribal chiefs had acquired a taste, like their Celtic predecessors many centuries before in Central Europe. Irish exports probably included pelts and hides. For many of the later centuries, this was to be a staple of the country's external commerce, and perhaps fish. Some quantities of materials not available in the country, such as tin for making bronze, must have been included in the imports. Perhaps salt was one of them. There are indications that the Romans brought hunting dogs from Ireland, but these can hardly be seen as great importance in trade. Yet overseas traffic was sufficient to provide business for enterprising seamen. St. Patrick's account of his escape from slavery and from Ireland on board what would appear to have been a small merchant ship, seemingly Irish, is one of the several glimpses he gives us into the social history of the 5th century. We'll take a short break there. According to the history programme tonight, I've been speaking with William J. Maguire of CAPA, and Billy is President of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and we've been paying homage to St. Patrick, whose feast day is next Monday, and whom all Irishmen and women will celebrate. And Billy stayed with me through the programme, and you'd just like to say something, Billy, about the Peace and Reconciliation.
Well, I would. It's very important, you know, St. Patrick's Day, because the Irish Republican Brotherhood were founded, as we said, on St. Patrick's Day. And, you know, we lived down in Willowbank, where the university is now. And that was predicated on, as you know, that university is an Irish Republican Brotherhood university. And the Peace, Reconciliation and Prosperity process, as I said, Willowbank is where the Supreme Council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood met. And the peace process was founded in 1950 by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and was predicated on the sovereign constitution, that we would go back again to 1922, when everything went wrong, and to put in place the sovereign government of Dáil Éireann, the Dáil Éireann courts, and, you know, the ratification of the War of Independence. And that hasn't been done. And all this about, you know, that happened in Good Friday and Belfast Agreement, I mean, that's not legal, valid or bona fides. And you have to, you'll get, that's not going to continue until you go back to 1922. And I'm saying it here and now, you have to go back. That was predicated on that. And as we said, that is where the Supreme Council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood met.
Okay. I'll tell you another thing, Billy, which will probably play out very importantly, is this emergence of a free Scotland.
I think that is crucial. I mean, we have a British apartheid state, and South Africa has got rid of theirs, and here we're stuck with it, and nothing has been done about it, only colluding with Britain on it. Right. And Scotland is...
This referendum to have whether they offer independence or whether they don't, that the nationalist genie will be out of the bottle.
Look, Seamus, people are sovereign. They're born sovereign. That is, Celtic people are born sovereign in the world. We're not subject to anybody or crowns or anything else, and we own the land of Ireland has belonged to the, but that's in the sovereign constitution.
No, no.
And you have a sovereign right to education, hospital care, home, and all the assets of the state, instead of them all being given away to every other country.
I know
we own those, and that's, people should stand up for it.
Okay, very good. Thank you again, Billy, for coming on the program. And I'd like to tell the listeners that next week I'll be joined by John Cousin here from Newcastle, and John is chairman of the Tormont Historical Society in Southern Limerick, and a good historian himself, and always a pleasure to talk to, really. And I have a couple more lined up, so with a bit of luck, that we will continue to entertain you and to educate you. And I always say that history is very important. If you don't know who you are, you know, you're a very poor person. You might think it has no value, but it really has fundamental value. And I see myself, the emergence of a free Scotland, having a large play here in the future of the Irish people, particularly, we'll say, the Northern Irish people, or the people in the Ulster. And so we have to be hopeful, really, and look forward to the 100th anniversary of 1916, which will have to bring hope to our people again. I'd like to thank Donal for looking after us, and Billy again for coming in. So I go in Uishla, good day and shahan shakoing, shashem so solo on a raw, good day shif slan.